Lauren disappeared before dawn Friday. The petite fashion student, 4 feet 11 inches, barely 100 pounds, has a dangerous heart condition that requires medication. She was walking home from a night out at a bar at a party. But surveillance video confirmed she never made it home.
We feel like there certainly could be foul play involved.
I start my everyday hoping that today is the day. I go to sleep every night knowing that I have failed and that I haven't done enough.
Cocaine, Xanax, all types of different drugs, marijuana. Some people dipped into acid. It was just a whole bunch of college kids that had money and could afford to do the things that they were doing.
She actually falls down twice in this alley, according to surveillance cameras. He eventually grabs her, throws her over his shoulder in a fireman's carry, and literally carries her the rest of the way.
She was not cared for in a way that I would want my son to care for another. And that's what kind of gets me, because the circumstances, I think, could have been a lot different had Lauren been escorted back to her apartment.
Friends say Lauren Spear walked home alone early Friday morning after a night out. No one has seen or heard from her since.
Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick. Happy 4th of July, everybody.
Today we're talking about a case, the case of missing college student Laura Spearer, and this episode is called Looking for Lauren. Now, on June 3rd, 2011, Indiana University sophomore Lauren Spearer vanished from the streets of Bloomington. She has not been seen since. Her heartbroken parents, Charlene and Rob Spearer, continue their search for answers, even though it's been 5 years now. Now, in their search for clues, Lauren's parents learned that Indiana University has a thriving drug scene and that Lauren was actually a part of it. They concede that not all of Lauren's choices the night she disappeared were smart decisions, but they, along with the local police, believe that she had met with foul play. Now, let's go ahead and do a couple of five-star reviews and get our beer poured. And then we'll start talking about Lauren Spearer and the Lauren Spearer case. So one 5-star review I wanted to read today is called Charming, and I like that name. So Charming, it says, it is by Mr. No Such. And this review says, yes, it's not the most polished podcast in the world, but I actually find that refreshing. Not everything needs to be edited ad nauseum. I feel as if I'm listening to friends chat about a case over drinks, and that it is relaxing and enjoyable. Love Dick's very dry humor and delivery, and the interactions between the two of them feel authentic. Looking forward to more episodes. So, Mr. No Such, welcome to the brewery.
Welcome to the brewery. And if there's one thing we're not, it's really finely polished.
No. And I don't know if we aim to be.
I don't.
No, we might polish up a bit. And then the next one I wanted to read is, it's called An Outstanding True Crime Podcast, and this is by Long Live Maiden. Long Live Maiden says, just listened to my first episode, so well done. I love both of the host styles, the research and the narrative are excellent. Really looking forward to catching up. I can't believe I didn't find this earlier. So that's flattering.
That is, I like that one.
Yep. So welcome to the brewery, Long Live Maiden. Or is it Long Live Maiden?
I think Long Live.
Long Live Maiden?
I guess.
Okay.
Sure. Let's do that.
Well, welcome, Maiden.
Okay.
And let's go ahead and do your beer review. What beer did you bring for us tonight?
Well, this crime or disappearance, I guess it's not a crime yet. The disappearance of this young lady took place in Indiana. And there's lots of good Indiana beers. I picked one called Zombie Dust.
I like the name a lot.
It's a pretty cool name.
As a friend of the zombie genre.
This is one of those beers that people stand in line for.
Really?
Anyway, it's brewed by Three Floyds Brewing Company out of Munster, Indiana. And it's an American Pale Ale. So an APA, also like a lot of other beers, has its origin in British beers. The character of the beer varies from region to region. But generally, you can expect a good balance of malt and hops. The fruity esters can vary from none to moderate, and the bitterness can vary from lightly floral to really pungent. So Zombie Dust, this particular beer, is a deep golden color with a thick white head that left a good amount of lace. There's a big citrus aroma up front on first sniff, with some piney resin type of stuff later on. And the taste is just like the nose promised. It's a very juicy taste, lots of citrus, with some faint pine. This is kind of a medium-bodied beer, very clean finish. I can see why people stand in line for it.
Hmm. Okay, and what kind of glasses will we be drinking out of?
Actually, this is a pint glass time.
Oh, okay.
I know you're looking for the snifter, but I would choose a pint for this one.
Okay, that sounds great. Okay, let's take our pint glasses and cruise on down to the quiet end of the bar to talk about Looking for Lauren.
I'm ready.
Now, Lauren Spearer, she grew up in the New York City suburb of Scarsdale. Her parents say that she had a real love for life. She was exceptionally caring and full of energy. Now, when Charlene and Rob moved Lauren into her dorm in 2009, they felt that she was in a safe place. And after Lauren's disappearance, her parents were shocked to find out that Lauren was heavily involved in the campus party scene. It was at 2:30 a.m. the night that she vanished. She left Kilroy's bar, and she left without her shoes or her cell phone, which makes us think she probably had had a little too much to drink.
Yeah, she had been what they call pre-gaming beforehand with some friends. So she was probably pretty intoxicated by the time she got to Kilroy's.
Yeah, and they didn't get to Kilroy's until around 2 a.m.
Yeah.
And they only stayed a half an hour or so.
Right.
So that's a little funny. I don't know if they went there just to pick something up or to meet someone, but they weren't there very long.
No, they weren't. But as you said, just the fact that her shoes or sandals, whatever she was wearing, and her cell phone were left behind at the bar would indicate to me that she was kind of intoxicated when she left.
I think so. Part of that is that the patio or the sitting outside area had sand, so it was kind of not too abnormal to take your shoes off. But to actually leave without your cell phone or your shoes, you'd right. have to be not thinking quite too clearly.
No, I can see taking your shoes off because you're in the patio area where there's sand, but then you put them back on and you take your cell phone when you leave.
Right. Now, on that night that she disappeared, she was partying with several male friends. Her boyfriend, Jesse Wolf, said he didn't go out with her or her friends that evening, but he said he was texting back and forth with her before he went to bed. According to witnesses, Lauren was very intoxicated. And using video surveillance footage and witness statements, the Bloomington police were able to create a timeline of her whereabouts before her disappearance. Now let's go over the timeline a little bit, if you don't mind.
No, I think that's a very instructive thing to do, because it's going to tell us a lot.
Yep. So this was a Thursday night, an early Friday morning technically, and it was around 12:30 a.m. when witnesses report that Lauren left her apartment with a friend named David Ron, and the two of them went to Jay Rosenbaum's apartment. That's a friend of hers back from high school. And Lauren met up with someone there named Corey Rossman, who was a friend of Jay's and also a neighbor who lived in the same apartment building as Jay Rosenbaum.
Right, but he was a new guy. I mean, she hadn't met him or didn't have many things to do with him beforehand. This was kind of like a new acquaintance.
Yes, yes, and they were introduced. I don't know if they were introduced because he was hanging out with Jay. I'm not sure how that worked out, but she ended up going to Kilroy's bar around 1:45 a.m., and she was seen at 2:27 a.m. leaving the bar with Rossman. Now, she, like we said, she left her cell phone and her shoes at the bar, and when she'd taken off her shoes to walk on the sand-covered patio, Rossman walked with her and actually ended up walking off with her towards her apartment complex.
So they Do they go to the bar together, or they just happen to meet up there?
I think they went together. It says she met up with him at Jay Rosenbaum's apartment.
Right.
So I believe they went there together.
So they went there together.
Yes.
And left together.
Yes.
Okay.
Now, it was around 2:30 that she was seen entering Smallwood Plaza Apartments. That's where her apartment was. And a passerby named Zach Oakes noticed that she was very inebriated, and he asked if she was okay. Now, Rossman, Corey Rossman, who was the guy that was with her, he had replied, "She's okay, I got it." But Oakes stated that he told Rossman to take her back to her room. So he thought it was a little weird or a little not cool.
Right. Plus, they're right there in her apartment. So
right.
Put her in her room and let her sleep.
Yeah. Now, Rossman, who was obviously inebriated too, he cursed at Oakes, and it led to an altercation in which Oakes punched him and actually knocked him to the floor. So Rossman later on claimed that this punch caused him to lose his memory of the evening, or his lawyers said that. His lawyers claimed that.
Somebody said that. I think there's been different versions. I don't think in some of the things we've looked at and seen that he's always denied it. And he said that he had amnesia for the event. And I think you could. I mean, if you have a mild concussion, you can have amnesia and not remember what's been going on.
Right.
And maybe recover it later. Who knows? But I don't find that totally unbelievable.
Well, I think maybe that could be related to being drunk as well. You certainly forget things when you've had too much to drink.
Oh, sure.
Right?
Yeah. I think that if he was drunk and he was impaired anyway, and then the blow to the head on top of it, sure.
Okay. So around 2:42 a.m., and this is according to surveillance footage, which has been indicated by the police and explained, but has never been released to anybody, the public or the parents or anybody. So there is this surveillance footage that hasn't been released that would show that she exited her apartment complex at around 2:42 a.m., and the police reported that she did not go to her apartment during the short visit. The surveillance video showed her stumbling and Corey Rossman helping her to her feet and walking out of the building. Now, a few minutes later, she's witnessed by a bystander sitting down on a staircase outside and falling backwards, hitting her head on the concrete step. The noise of this impact was loud enough for the bystander to hear it and ask whether she was all right. So that's a significant bump.
Yeah, she fell, and it sounds like she didn't try to stop herself or anything and just whacked her head. Boom.
Yeah. Well, by all accounts, she was pretty out of it. And according to this woman, Rossman had replied, "She's okay, I'll take care of it." So they continued up the street, Rossman and Lauren. And Lauren was witnessed falling again. Because of her intoxication level, she didn't even raise her hands to cushion the blow when she fell, and her face hit the ground unguarded. And then a few steps later, she fell a third time. And at this point, Rossman just picked her up and threw her over his shoulder and started carrying her. Now, Lauren was 4'11" and 90 pounds, so she was a tiny girl.
Yeah, so she's easy to pick up and put in a fireman's carry and just off you go.
Yeah. So I feel like this night she was very vulnerable.
It sounds like. Sounds like she's pretty defenseless.
Yes. Really unprotected.
Yep.
And then it was around 2:48 a.m., so only 6 minutes later, that they left that apartment building, and she entered an alley that runs between College Avenue and Morton Street. Security cameras mounted on nearby apartments show her exit through the alley at 2:51 a.m. and walk toward an empty lot. Spearer's keys and purse were found along this route through the alley. Now, Spearer, Lauren, and Corey Rossman arrived at Rossman's apartment shortly after that. Michael Beth, who was Rossman's roommate, was at the apartment. Rossman, as we said, was very intoxicated, and he was stumbling. And as soon as he stumbled in, he vomited on the carpet on the stairs, on the way upstairs. Now, his roommate, Michael Beth, stated that he escorted Corey Rossman to bed, and then he tried to persuade Lauren to sleep over their apartment for her own safety. But then he claimed that she said she wanted to return to her own apartment and she wouldn't stay.
Right. But he at least from the reports, was trying to help her. He said, you ought to stay here tonight. You're not in any condition to be out wandering around.
Right. But then he did let her leave.
He did. But didn't he end up calling a neighbor who knew Lauren?
Yeah. It was, it was around 3:30 that he said that he phoned his neighbor, and this was Jay Rosenbaum. So this is the friend of Lauren's since high school.
This is someone she knew.
Yep.
Has known for a while.
Mm-hmm. And he wanted him to take care of Lauren. And then he said that Lauren was attempting to get him to drink with her at her own apartment. So he's saying that Lauren wanted him to go to her apartment after that and drink some more.
But right. And if that's the case, I mean, it sounds like she's still really out of it.
Yeah. But she's able to talk, which surprises me, after falling down 3 times and all this.
Right.
Being carried.
But it doesn't sound like she was that coherent, you know. Well, come back to my place and drink with me.
Right. So she eventually did go over to Jay Rosenbaum's apartment, where he observed that there was a bruise under her eye, and that's presumably sustained in the falls that she had earlier in the evening, where she didn't block her face with her hands because she was so out of it.
Right.
Now, she told him she didn't know how she got the bruise, and then there were 2 calls placed from Jay Rosenbaum's phone shortly before she's reported to have left his apartment. Rosenbaum says that Lauren placed both the calls, one to Ron, which was the friend she was with earlier. What was his first name? Do you remember? Was it John? David Ron.
Okay.
Yeah, David Ron. So
So this was the guy that she had started the evening with?
Yep.
He didn't accompany her to Kilroy's?
No. She met up with Corey Rossman, when she was at David Ron's. And then both the calls that she made from Rosenbaum's at around 3:30 in the morning, one was to David Ron, and the other was to another male friend who I can't find out who that was. That hasn't been specified in any of the literature or anything that I've found.
You know, it's interesting.
What?
I mean, her boyfriend, Jesse Wolf.
Yes.
Decided he'd stay home and watch the NBA Finals.
He did.
And not go out with him. And he's not one of the people she apparently tried to call.
No.
So I think that's interesting.
Okay.
I don't know if it's significant, but this is a kid she's been dating for quite some time. And she doesn't call him or doesn't try to call him.
Yeah. And why isn't he out with her? That's another strange thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. Neither of the calls that she made were picked up, though, and she didn't leave any messages with them.
Okay.
So then it was around 4:30 when Jay Rosenbaum reported that Lauren had left his apartment. Now, this is the last reported sighting of her. He reported last seeing Lauren at the intersection of 11th Street and College Avenue, and he says she was headed south on College, which would have been towards her apartment, and she was last seen wearing black leggings and a white shirt. She had no shoes.
And no cell phone.
No.
And no keys, so she wasn't going to get into her apartment anyway.
No.
And no ID.
Right.
But off she goes.
Yeah, I think that's really irresponsible of this guy.
For sure.
If he's a friend of hers for years, why is he letting her go off like this?
I think any of these guys that she was around that night didn't behave well.
No.
And I think it was her father who really keyed on that that's not the way he would want a son of his to act towards a woman.
Right. Yeah, he didn't even call her boyfriend, Jesse Wolf, and say, you know, Lauren's here, she's had too much to drink, she wants to take off on her own, you need to come get her.
Right. Or she says, I'm going back to my dorm, why don't you go with her?
Just walk her there, just, make just sure she gets there.
To make sure she gets her okay. I mean,
right.
This is just totally, to me, irresponsible.
It is irresponsible. I don't understand it.
Nope. I don't either.
Yeah. So Jesse Wolf, her boyfriend, had sent her a text, and she hadn't replied, obviously because her phone was at the bar, and he received a reply from an employee of the bar. And that's when Wolf decided that, oh, she's missing, and he called Lauren's sister, who contacted Lauren's parents to say Lauren's missing.
Yeah, and there's another thing that I'm wondering about. I mean, so he calls her or texts her on her cell, and somebody at the bar answers the text.
Correct.
And I'm not sure how he goes from there to thinking she's missing.
Well, this is several hours later, so this is he hasn't been getting a hold of her, I would think, since like 4 or 4:30 he's been trying to get a hold of her.
Yeah.
That's the way I interpreted
but,
it.
But, I mean, somebody at the bar answers him and says, I've got her phone at the bar. So maybe he just figures she left the phone there.
Okay.
I mean, I don't see how he immediately gets into she's missing, but, I mean, that's probably not a big point.
Well, and I'm not sure if he said exactly she's missing, but he couldn't find her at that point, and he called her sister.
Yeah.
So this was probably like 7:30, 8:30 in the morning. I'm not sure of the exact time.
Yeah.
It's, but it's been a while since he heard from her.
Right.
And perhaps he did call Rosenbaum, too. He might have called other people looking for her, as far as I know, and realized, you know, nobody knows where she is.
Yeah, he might have. He probably did.
But it's just strange to me that he didn't check on her sooner, or he wasn't worried that she was out with all these other guys.
Yeah.
Just odd to me.
Very.
Yeah. So, you know, there was quite an investigation, and it was in August of 2011 that police conducted a 9-day search of the Sycamore Ridge landfill in Pimento. And this is after, you know, a couple months of searching neighborhoods, woods, property. And they decided to search that, which was, you know, pretty disturbing for the parents, because anything you find there is going to be bad.
No kidding.
Right. So they searched for clues as well as for her body. And the landfill, that's where trash from Bloomington gets hauled off after it stops at a transfer station. So the Bloomington Police Department, the Indiana University Police Department, and the FBI, they all took part in that search and found nothing.
Nobody.
Nope. And then by May of 2013, investigators had received over 3,000 tips on Lauren's disappearance, and 100 of them were received during the first half of 2013 and had really led to nothing.
This is 2 years after the disappearance.
Right, right.
So they get lots of tips, but nothing fruitful.
Correct, yes. Now, some of the more recent theories and speculations. There have been some very recent ones, actually. On January 28th of 2016, the FBI conducted a raid of a home in Martinsville, Indiana. Now, that's about 20 miles north of Bloomington. And this was in connection with a man suspected of exposing himself to numerous women. The FBI and other police agencies converged on this home with the Bloomington police, confirming that they were involved in the search. Now, investigators sifted through dirt removed from a barn near the property after some cadaver dogs finished their work there. The searchers would not discuss whether anything significant was found. Investigators towed a white truck from the property. Now, they said the truck may be connected to 35-year-old Justin Wagers, who lived there with his mother and his stepmother. But nothing has come of that either. Now, a number of theories have emerged regarding the evening that she went missing. Lauren's parents have stated that they believe she is deceased at this point. Now, based on her level of intoxication, they also feel that she may have been drugged by someone at the bar. Maybe someone slipped her a Mickey in her drink or something.
Or a roofie.
A roofie.
I don't know about Mickeys anymore.
What's a Mickey?
I don't know. Mickey okay. Finn. It's oh. It's something that intoxicates you.
Okay. Well, a Cosby-type pill.
Yes.
Yes. So her parents said that while they felt that somebody could have slipped something into her drink at Kilroy's, that definitely could not be confirmed, but she did seem to be more intoxicated than she would have been just from having the drinks that she had at Kilroy's, obviously. Although it is believed that she had cocaine and other things prior to going to Kilroy's.
Well, yeah, I would just say that if they weren't at Kilroy's for that long, so it's doubtful that what she drank at Kilroy's made her that intoxicated.
Unless something was put in her drink.
Right.
Right.
But if that were the case, her new friend, what's his name?
Corey Rossman.
If that was the intent, he could have worked on that, and they went back to her place. They never went into her room. So if his intent was to have intercourse with her by slipping her a roofie or something, he didn't act on it.
No, but there were those people in the hallway that saw him.
Well, yeah.
And punched him, so he might have felt it wasn't safe to take advantage of her there.
Yeah, but he could have said, I'm just making sure I'm getting her home okay.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's all speculation. That's true.
But in any event, if she had done alcohol and other drugs before hitting Kilroy's, that could have been what really made her intoxicated, and not that she was slipped a date rape drug.
Absolutely, yes. Right. That's what I'm saying. It could be either. Yes, you're right. Now, Lauren's family have voiced their suspicions about the men that she was with that evening, as well as her boyfriend, Jesse Wolf. Since they have refused to take police-issued polygraphs, and they have retained lawyers soon after Lauren's disappearance. We did talk a bit about this, Dick, about getting lawyers, and how that doesn't necessarily mean that you are guilty of anything.
For sure. I mean, I think in this day and age, you're stupid if you go into questioning by the police without an attorney.
Yeah, and I think most parents know that, and if their son is questioned on anything like this, I mean, especially after the, what was that rape case that was false? What college was that? Was it Notre Dame? There was a rape case where a girl had falsely accused these boys.
That was Duke.
Duke, okay. So any kind of case like that, you have a boy in college that gets accused of something, or being even involved anywhere near something, I think you want to get them an attorney.
Oh, definitely.
To protect them.
I mean, I don't see anything out of the ordinary or anything suspicious about them lawyering up.
Okay. That's
what I would tell my kid.
Right. But you can see how that's frustrating for her parents.
Well, I certainly can. But I think that's just prudent on the part of the kids.
Yeah. And, you know, her parents haven't made any specific accusations towards any of these young men, but they do believe that they may know more than they've told the police.
I think they're correct in that assumption.
You do?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So that means that you do think they're guilty of something?
Absolutely.
Okay, but you just said that getting a lawyer doesn't make them guilty.
No.
But you think they're guilty?
But I think they've done something, yeah.
Okay. All right.
I'll explain that later.
Okay. Well, the men respond to them by saying that they have taken privately administered polygraphs, as well as one administered by the FBI. They said they do not trust the Bloomington police, and they have retained lawyers to protect themselves, and I guess we could say that's fair. I don't see any problem with that.
I see no problem with that.
Yeah. Now, regarding Lauren's level of intoxication, her friends and her boyfriend told police that in addition to alcohol, she did use drugs on the night in question, as well as regularly leading up to her disappearance. She actually did have a charge against her about a year and a half prior to her disappearance for possession of cocaine, which was going to be dropped after a certain amount of time of staying out of trouble because it was her first offense.
Right. And they found cocaine in her room after she went missing.
They did, yes. Now, Jesse Wolf's mother alleged that Lauren was actually asked to leave a summer camp where she met her son. She met her son, Jesse. Lauren met this woman's son, Jesse, at the summer camp years before this. And she says that Lauren was asked to leave the camp because of drug use. So she believes that Lauren did have a chronic drug problem for several years. It wasn't something new. And she believes that her drug abuse is at the heart of why she's not around anymore. Not that that's what killed her, but it certainly caused this to happen or influenced, actually made her vulnerable to whatever happened to her. You could at least say that.
Yes, I would say that.
Yeah. Now, Rosenbaum, he also knew her since back in camp. They'd known each other a long time. Now, he told investigators that Lauren snorted cocaine and some crushed up Klonopin tablets that evening. Now, remember, she'd been with him before she met up with Corey, and they took off together to Kilroy's. So she had been with him earlier in the night as well as afterwards.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And just for those who might not know, everybody knows what cocaine is, but Klonopin is a seizure medication.
Okay.
But people commonly crush it and snort it to get high.
Okay, now is this like a cocaine-type high, or is it more of a narcotic type high that levels you out? What kind of a...
No, it's more like a cocaine additive type of thing.
Oh, okay.
So you get a better buzz.
Now, she did that along with alcohol as well.
Yeah.
Now, what's the danger of mixing Klonopin and cocaine and alcohol?
Well, it's a bad cocktail for sure.
Okay.
I mean, these things can all potentiate each other, so it will probably heighten her degree of inebriation.
Exactly,
and
yeah.
And it sounds like that's what happened. I mean, here she is stumbling and falling and smacking her head on the ground and even recognizing it.
Yeah. Now, adding to that danger of the drug use was that Lauren actually had a rare heart condition called long QT syndrome. Police addressed rumors that implied that Lauren may have overdosed, that she had overdosed, and that some of these guys may have hidden her body in order to avoid criminal charges. And they acknowledged that they've not ruled that out. But they stressed that there are also other possibilities, such as stranger abduction. Anyway, the long QT syndrome, I wanted you to tell us a little bit about that, if you don't mind, and how that works with these drugs that she was taking as well.
It's an interesting syndrome. It's a congenital or acquired heart condition where there is delayed repolarization of the heart following a heartbeat, and that increases the risk of an arrhythmia called ventricular fibrillation.
Okay. Can you dumb that down just a little?
Sure.
Okay.
So when you look at a cardiogram, there's points on it.
A cardiogram is EKG?
EKG. You know, it's an electrical recording of the heart's beat.
Okay.
And when you look at it, there are points on it called complexes. There's a Q, R, S, T, and sometimes a U. So, and you look at intervals. So the QT interval is the timing between the Q peak and the T peak.
Right, yep.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And if it's sufficiently long enough, that predisposes you to rhythm disturbances of the heart. So, and the big one is ventricular fibrillation, where the ventricles just don't pump. They just kind of vibrate. So there's no effective heartbeat.
Now, is that like a heart attack or is that different?
No, it's different.
Okay.
But the end result is that you can die from it.
Okay. So how likely is something like that to happen? I heard she was on medication for it. What kind of medication do people take for that?
Well, there's a couple things you can do for that. And there's apparently a whole host of genetic syndromes that cause it. And depending on the length of the interval, basically the shorter the QT interval, the better. The longer it is, the worse it is for a prognosis. So you can take some medicine. Usually people would take a beta blocker, which is a drug that decreases the risk of a rhythm problem in people with long QT syndrome.
Okay.
You can also, if you're at a high enough risk, have an implantable cardioverter defibrillator that would automatically kick in if you have ventricular fibrillation.
Okay.
So she apparently wasn't in that high risk group because I think we would have heard something about her having a device implanted. And what we've heard is that she's on a medication, which I'm assuming was a beta blocker, to try to prevent these occurrences. Now, going further from that, so she's already at risk.
Right, right.
Because of her condition. Cocaine can further increase the QT interval, which would heighten your risk even more. Mm-hmm. And there's some reports that Klonopin can also do the same thing.
Oh, that's not good.
So it sounds like you could be taking these various pharmaceuticals and dramatically increase your risk of having a fatal arrhythmia of the heart.
Now, I wonder if she was aware of the risk with that.
Well,
she must have had a cardiologist.
She had to have had a cardiologist, and someone would have been likely to tell her what the risks were and what things to avoid. I mean, I know she was told that she couldn't participate in sports anymore.
That's right.
Because of the risk of ventricular fibrillation. So I think any doctor worth his salt would say, here's what you got. Don't do this, don't do that, and so on.
Now, do you routinely tell patients things like that? I mean, you're going to tell a patient general health things, like you can't do sports anymore, but are you going to think to tell someone don't do cocaine or that you're at an increased risk if you do these street drugs? Is that common?
I don't know if that's common. I mean, from my standpoint, if it was me talking to an adolescent teen,
yeah,
that's redundant anyway.
Well, or a young adult.
If I was talking to a young adult, I would say that there are specific things, such as cocaine, that can make the condition worse.
Right.
But I don't know. I'm just speculating as to whether her cardiologist, I am reasonably certain that she saw a cardiologist.
Well, yes. I don't think that a general practitioner would prescribe medication for that, would they? Wouldn't they want her to at least see a cardiologist intermittently? Yeah.
I mean, if it was me seeing this kid, they get to a cardiologist right away.
Yeah. And then on a regular basis?
Yes.
Yeah.
Cardiologist does the follow-up and adjusts the meds and does all the things to assume the care of that patient.
And then do they do an EKG every year or so to see, is this something that can get worse as you get older, as time goes by?
No.
It's usually changed?
Actually worse when you're younger.
Oh, so it might improve.
Well, it won't worsen.
Okay.
I mean, that's maybe semantics, but the younger you are, the more at risk you are. Females are more at risk than males, and it goes on and on.
And I wonder what her parents knew about this, about the risk. They were aware that she had had some drug use and she'd gotten in trouble. I wonder if they'd had the discussion about that.
We can only speculate about that.
Yeah.
But this isn't a benign condition. This is a potentially life-threatening disease. Just not a good thing to have.
No, and exercise. Now, why is that dangerous? Is it because it makes your heart rate go faster like cocaine does?
Well, certainly with exercise, you'll increase your heart rate. And as you do that, the more likely you are to have delayed repolarization and a rhythm disturbance that leads to death. So exercise is definitely out.
Is this one of those things where somebody might not know they have it and they're an athlete and they just drop dead?
Sure.
That's one of those type
things? That's one of those type things.
Okay. All right. So there's this guy, Bo Deedle, and he's a private investigator hired by Lauren's family. And he was very dubious that a drug overdose death would be enough motive for these guys to hide her body. He cited the prevalence of drug abuse on the Indiana University campus. He said every kid's buying pot, cocaine, drinking pills. He said, I mean, it's all over the place, so that really can't be a motive behind it. I find that a really sad comment. I don't know about you.
Well, it's not just a sad comment. I think he's totally ignoring her underlying medical condition.
Yeah, yeah.
And maybe for a normal, healthy kid who's using cocaine and Klonopin and marijuana and alcohol, it might not have fatal consequences. But if you take a kid with this underlying long QT syndrome, that's a potentially bad mix. So I mean, he should have been aware of her underlying medical condition because he was hired by the parents. But that's just a stupid comment to make.
Well, I think what he's saying, though, is not just that it was not anything about whether that was a risk to her, but he's saying that these guys wouldn't have a motive to hide her body because, what's he saying, like a drug overdose, isn't that unusual, I guess he's kind of saying? That, you know, these guys wouldn't be that worried about going to prison for her death?
Yeah, well, and I disagree with that also.
Yeah.
I mean,
I know.
If I'm a 19, 20, 21-year-old college kid and this woman dies on me, I would want to hide that.
Would you?
I think I'd be worried that I'd be charged with manslaughter or convicted of giving her the drugs that led to her death. I mean, there's a bunch of reasons to me why I would want to hide the body.
Well, if you were that kind of a person, I think a decent human being, though, would just be worried about getting her help and letting her parents know something had happened to her.
We've already gone on that. We're on record as saying that they all behave badly.
True. Okay. Now, there's this other thing that was brought up. It was brought up on a couple of the investigative reports that I read, and also in the Wikipedia page, and also on it wasn't the 2020 episode, but it was another episode. Maybe it was John Walsh or something. But it was this missing white woman syndrome. Have you heard of that?
Absolutely.
Oh, you have? Okay.
Yeah.
What is it? Tell me about it.
Well, if you're a young, relatively good-looking, affluent, white female, and you go missing, you're going to get a lot more publicity about that than if you were poor, undereducated, black, any number of things.
You're exactly right. I was not aware that this was a syndrome.
Well, I don't know that it's a syndrome, but for sure, you know that the attractive white females are the ones that get the most publicity.
Yes, yeah.
When they go missing.
Also, the wealthier people.
Right.
Yeah. Now, the Indiana University paper actually ran a story documenting the disparity between their own coverage of Lauren's disappearance and their coverage of another local disappearance of a woman named Crystal Grubb. Now, she wasn't a student at the university. Grubb, who was 29, was also Caucasian, but she came from a working-class family wherein many relatives had criminal histories. And following Grubb's disappearance in 2010, the student paper ran a total of 7 stories on the case, compared to multiple front-page articles and the extensive volunteer presence and the national awareness of Lauren's case. Now, an acquaintance of Grubb's commented, "When Crystal went missing, it was in the newspaper like once. For Lauren's disappearance, everyone here and there's posters everywhere, people walking around. Definitely nothing like that was afforded for Crystal. I don't want to say it's because she was of a lower economic class, but that's what it seems like to me."
Well, that's exactly what it was.
Yeah. So what does that say about us as a society that we're more interested in these people? Is it us or is it the media that's presenting it that way?
Oh, it's both. I mean, the media does it because that's what's going to generate the most interest.
But why? Why is that more interesting to us?
Well, again, it's because it's a attractive young female versus a poor, uneducated, less attractive female.
Well, they didn't say anything about her attractiveness. They said that she was from a working class family.
Right. But, the good-looking girls are always going to get more publicity. And the blondes, I mean, I'm sorry, I'm sounding sexist and stuff, but a good-looking blonde is going to get lots of hits.
Yeah, I don't know why. I don't quite understand that.
I don't either.
But it is a phenomena.
But that's how it works.
Okay. Now, there was also a civil suit was brought forward. And that was Lauren's parents filing a civil suit against Corey Rossman, Jay Rosenbaum, and Michael Beth. The suit accused the men of negligence, alleging that Rossman and Rosenbaum supplied Lauren with the alcohol after she was already visibly intoxicated, and then neglected to assure that she returned safely to her apartment, which likely led to her death. Now, the family stated that they hope the lawsuit will lead to the men's coming forward with more information about what occurred. But that lawsuit was thrown out. The court decided that even though this behavior was reprehensible, not good behavior, that these guys had no responsibility to her to take care of her.
Right.
Yep.
I mean, I can see the parents' viewpoint, particularly the one guy who said, "Stay here," and she doesn't. I mean, so you're trying to assume care of her.
Right.
And he let her go. But I don't think the lawsuit really had merit, at least legal merit.
No, well, it didn't. It was thrown out.
Probably moral merit, it would have worked.
Right. Now, as part of that suit, this was interesting. Her parents subpoenaed the private cell phone and academic records spanning 134 days before and after the night their daughter disappeared. And that was a move that the men in question called a fishing expedition. And none of the men have been named as suspects in the disappearance. Federal Judge Tanya Pratt dismissed the suit, as I said, and in 2013, she ruled that they had no duty to care for Lauren, and Lauren's parents had also alleged in the suit that Beth, the roommate, had assumed duty of care for her when he offered her a place to sleep and then escorted her to Jason Rosenbaum's apartment. But the judge said that on public policy that it would dissuade people from rendering assistance and not, you know, go out of their way to help people if they found that they could be found responsible for what happens to them. And she said that she didn't want to dissuade folks from being involved at all by punishing them if someone later on decides to do something and people decide that they didn't do enough for that person.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, that's all legalese. I think you have a moral responsibility to help this woman who's clearly intoxicated out of her mind.
Well, I definitely agree, but do we want to make that a law? Do we need to make that a law?
No, I don't think so. That's why I'm trying to distinguish between legal and moral.
Right, right.
I mean, I don't think there's any legal precedent And that's what the judge said.
Yes.
But, geez, help this kid out.
You know. Well, the lawyers for these men have stated that their clients have cooperated fully with the police and the private investigators that were hired by Lauren's family.
Well, of course they're going to say that. That's all bullshit stuff anyway. I mean, that's, you know.
Well, according to their lawyers, they've been interviewed over and over again. And, you know, they have been forthcoming. And putting forth this idea to the public that they haven't been forthcoming just because they have legal representation is not accurate.
No, probably. But, I mean, just the fact that the lawyers are saying they're being cooperative doesn't mean that they are.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Right.
I mean, the lawyers can say whatever they're paid to say.
Sure.
And so the word is, oh, yeah, my client is being fully cooperative, even if they're stonewalling them the whole way. I mean, the lawyers want the boys to be in a sympathetic light.
Well, it's so, their job to take care of
sure.
them. Yeah, sure.
I mean, that's what an attorney does. So the fact that they're saying, oh, my client's been fully cooperative doesn't mean squat to me.
Yeah. Okay. Would you like to talk about any of the other leads? I mean, they've gone nowhere, so I don't know if they're worth really talking about, but I thought maybe we should mention them.
Yeah.
You know, there was
some of them are almost laughable.
Yeah.
I mean, these have all come in on the tip line.
Yeah. Well, there were a couple on the, there was a 2020 episode the other night about Lauren.
Right. And these leads came from the tip line that the family had set up.
Right. Correct. Yeah.
So somebody dropped a dime on a guy who beat up his girlfriend.
Well, yeah. So there was a white truck that had circled the block where Lauren disappeared around the same time. And there was a guy named James McLish who owned a similar truck. It wasn't even identified to be his truck.
Who purportedly owned a similar truck.
Well,
it never was proven that he did own that truck.
Not that truck, but he did own a white truck. That was
maybe
that was a fact.
He might have. It's not a fact.
He admitted he owned a white truck.
Oh, did he?
Yes.
I thought that.
But there are many white trucks, as you know.
Well, okay.
Okay. Now, it was his ex-girlfriend who he had been arrested for assault against. So it was his ex-girlfriend who actually called the tip line, and she said that she thought he had killed Lauren and burned her on his farm in southern Indiana. And he had just gotten out of prison. He was just paroled shortly before Lauren disappeared. So the police actually didn't do anything with him, but this former FBI agent, Garrett, who now works as an ABC News consultant and was involved in the 2020 episode.
Right. He was hired by the parents, Lauren's parents.
Well, there were investigators hired by the parents, and then he worked with those investigators through the 2020. I think he's probably too expensive for them to hire. He's, you know, kind of a TV type guy now.
But he's helping them.
Yeah. So what they did is they got James McLish to take a polygraph, and he passed the polygraph. So he's been ruled out.
Scratch him.
Yeah, and there was no connection seen between them either.
Right.
Other than what the girlfriend had said. And then there was this one about the bike gang, the Sons of Silence.
Right.
Someone had called in.
This is the drug connection.
Yeah, someone had called in on this biker guy who went by the name of Bo Dean, and said that they thought that she owed drug money to him and that he had eliminated her. Now, there were no factual connections, and this FBI agent Garrett, former FBI agent Garrett, ruled him out and said there was nothing to that either. Now, there was one a little more interesting, I thought, was this Corey Hammersley, who was one of the kids that was with him that night. And after she went missing, he's the one that kind of went crazy and drugs, and he was shooting naked in the street. Remember that?
Yeah. They have a video of him.
Yeah. And thankfully he didn't kill anyone, but he was out naked shooting, and he did go to prison for 24 years for attempted murder. Now, one of his cellmates came forward claiming that he told him in prison that Lauren had OD'd with him and his friends and that they dumped her body in the Ohio River. So this could have some, this could be believable.
It could be.
But they haven't been able to prove that yet, but this former FBI agent, Garrett, does see that he wants to investigate that a little bit more, I guess.
Right. When they did interview him, on the 2020 episode. He denied any knowledge of it.
He did, but then they asked him, if you found anything out about it, would you let us know? And he said, no, I don't want to be involved.
Yeah.
Which...
I mean, there's definitely something suspicious about that guy.
Well, yeah. Well, yeah. You mean the one who told on him or the one who was shooting naked?
The one who was shooting naked.
Oh, that in and of itself is suspicious behavior, I believe.
Yes.
But I guess it was drug-related. I guess it was some kind of drug-induced psychosis.
Something made him go out naked and start shooting.
Yes. Yeah. And what else was there? Oh, there was April 2015, the Bloomington Police Department announced that they were investigating a possible link between Lauren's disappearance and the murder of another Indiana University student, Hannah Wilson. Wilson went missing April 24th, 2015, after visiting the same bar that Lauren was at the night she disappeared. Now, Wilson was last seen getting into a taxi in front of Kilroy's and driving away. Her body was found the next morning in Brown County, Indiana. I'm not quite sure how far away that is. But a local man named Daniel Messel was arrested for the murder after his cell phone was discovered near her body. Now, Lauren's parents previously stated that they did not believe Lauren's disappearance was a random abduction, which would be the case if this was the same guy. And in July 2015, the investigator, Bo Deedle, concluded that the two cases were unrelated, and any similarities between the two cases were only coincidental.
That sounds reasonable.
Mm-hmm. So I thought that we were going to talk a little bit about what we think might have happened. Do you want to do that?
I do.
Okay, I'm going to let you go ahead with that. You go ahead and tell me what you think happened. What is Dick's opinion?
Here's my opinion.
Okay.
So this guy, Corey, the new boy.
Corey Rossman?
The new friend.
Yes.
That she just met.
Yes.
Was the drug dealer that supplied her with drugs. This is my hypothetical reading.
Okay, so you're saying Lauren is at her friend's house, David Ron and Jason
Rosenbaum,
and that they had Corey come over to deliver drugs?
They did.
Okay.
And he supplied her with the drugs.
Is this the cocaine?
Cocaine, Klonopin, whatever.
Okay.
I'll say cocaine for sure.
Okay.
Again, speculation.
Yes, well, that's what we're doing now. We're speculating.
And he was with her. Now, I'm not sure exactly why he stayed with her. Maybe he was hoping to get lucky and have sex with her or something because her boyfriend wasn't around. But he's with her up to a point anyway. I'm not sure. I totally believe the story about him vomiting on the stairs and being put to bed by his roommate.
Okay.
See, I think they're all kind of complicit in this. Anyway, I think what happened was that she's drinking heavily. She took cocaine. She took Klonopin. And because of her cardiac illness, she had an arrhythmia and died.
Okay.
And I think they disposed of her body because these guys were afraid of the consequences of coming before the police and saying, gee, she just died.
Yeah. I mean, that's a hard thing to do, though, to make a body disappear. That's what makes me skeptical.
And that's my difficulty with saying that I think this is what happened. Because if they did dump her body in the Ohio River, she would have been found.
Mm-hmm.
At some point, unless they really weighted it down or something. But I don't have a good explanation for why the body hasn't ever been found, if what the guy's saying is true, that she died of an overdose and they disposed of her body in the Ohio River. I think she would have been found.
Yeah.
But I really think that the cause of her death was the drugs and her long QT syndrome.
Okay.
That's my theory.
Okay. I agree with you, I think, that that's a possibility. I also think it's possible that she wandered off towards her apartment and was picked up by somebody to take advantage of her and died the same way with them, and they hit her body.
That could be.
It's possible, too, I think.
But stranger abductions are pretty rare.
They are, but they happen.
They do.
Mm-hmm. And she was, you know, kind of the perfect target.
She'd be easy prey, for sure.
She would be.
But I considered that, too, and I'm just trying to look for what's the most likely explanation.
Okay.
And I think it's a drug overdose and resultant death from heart disease.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's more likely than a stranger abduction. But I wouldn't put that out of the realm of possibility either.
Right. Yeah. Now, unfortunately, the chances that Lauren is still alive are rather slim. Would you agree with me there?
Well, it's been 5 years, so I think there's very slim chances to no chance that she's still alive.
Okay. But I'd still like to use this case to discuss campus safety and the safety of young people as a whole, you know, when they go out partying and whatnot. The idea that Lauren was out and about on her own with no friends looking out for her best interests, that disturbs me.
Well, yeah, and I thought that these days that people, college kids, looked out for each other. That you're in a group, one of you is in trouble, the rest of the group takes care of you.
Well, that's how it was in my day. I remember experiences with my friends where they, you know, were about to leave, you know, a bar or a party with some strange person, and I stopped them and protected them and took them home.
Right.
You know, and that's how it's been. That's how I thought it was with girlfriends when you went out.
That's how you do it.
I mean,
now, she wasn't with girlfriends. She was with boys.
Yeah.
But still.
But why wasn't she with girlfriends? I don't know.
I don't either. And I don't know why somebody didn't say, you got to stay here. You can't leave. Or why they didn't tuck her in bed at her dorm.
Well, another thing that I consider with that is maybe this was kind of the norm for her. Maybe she was known for getting wasted and being irresponsible. And people, her friends just, well, friends, I don't know if they're friends, but the people she was with weren't really friends. They were just fellow drug users who didn't really look out for her. And it wasn't that unusual for her to behave this way. And I don't say that to put the blame on her. I mean, obviously she was irresponsible, but that doesn't mean she deserved what happened to her.
Right. You know, I can see that if she got that wasted on a regular basis, that they might not be as concerned.
Right. They might just think, oh, there she goes again.
Yeah.
Yep.
But still, the guy she was hanging out with, this new guy, I think he didn't maybe know her history because he's new.
Right.
He needed to take better care of her.
Well, I mean, from what you see in the story, he was just as irresponsible and probably just as intoxicated.
Probably.
Now, another concern is that the drug and alcohol use definitely seemed excessive. And is this normal for colleges? And if it is, that's worrisome.
Well, unfortunately, I think it is pretty much the norm.
Yeah, I kind of was of the thought that kids didn't drink and use drugs as much anymore, just like they didn't smoke as much as we used to in the 80s. And
well,
you know.
I don't think they smoke as much, but I'll bet they drink a lot more than we drank.
Huh.
And I'll bet they do a lot more drugs than we did.
Hmm. And then when you add to that, that this young woman was wandering around barefoot on her own, and these guys just let her go off on her own, knowing that she was extremely intoxicated, there's something just terribly wrong with the dynamics there. I mean, ethically, morally, something's really wrong there.
Absolutely.
And like I said, I don't know why she didn't have girlfriends that were with her, unless she was just so much into drugs, maybe she'd lost her other friends. Although, from what I heard, she did still have quite a few friends.
It looked like that, yeah. At least the 2020 episode that we watched, it looked like she still had plenty of girlfriends.
Yeah, it did. And then I don't understand her boyfriend, Jesse Wolf. I understand that you don't have to be with your boyfriend every night, but it's a little strange to just have her going off like that with different guys, some that she doesn't even know, while he stays home and doesn't even really notice that anything's happened to her until the next morning. And then I also wondered, if we're going to go into speculation, is it possible that he was jealous that she was with these guys and maybe he went and did something to her?
I suppose that's not out of the realm of possibility.
Mm-hmm.
I still find his story about, oh, I stayed up late watching the NBA finals and then I went to bed. Why didn't he go join his girlfriend at the bar?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, he did have a roommate who I guess backed him up on that, but still I find that odd.
Yeah, absolutely. So I don't know exactly about his whereabouts or story.
Right.
And the other guys, that are involved, Rosenbaum and Rossman. Rossman. Mm-hmm. I can't remember that. I mean, they know something.
Yeah.
And I think they know that she died and they got rid of the body.
Right. It doesn't say a lot for our future if these are the kind of people, but I suppose this is an exception. We're not going to...
I hope it's an exception and not the general rule.
I think it is. I don't think it's the general rule.
These guys just, they're pond scum.
And I do agree with what Lauren's father said about how that isn't how he would want his son to treat someone that he's with. And
absolutely not.
I do wonder what these young men's parents think, if they're upset with them.
We can only speculate.
Right.
I'm sure they're not real proud of their boys.
Well, you never know.
Nope.
Nope. Okay, well, I guess that does it, unless you want to add anything else about this.
I think we've said it all.
So this was our little bonus 4th of July episode.
Right. We're going to do another one in 2 or 3 days, so stick around.
That's right. So as all of you probably know, True Crime Brewery is available on iTunes. It's on Stitcher, and it's on Google Play. Our website for Tie Grabber Podcasts is www.tiegrabber.com. You can follow us on Twitter at Tie Grabber Pods. And we also have a Facebook page, facebook.com/tiegrabber.com. And we also have a Patreon page. So I will hope that we'll hear back about your opinions on this case. Like I said, we do have that voicemail that I keep encouraging people to use, the voicemail app on our website. So I'm hoping that'll happen someday.
We're still looking for our first voicemail.
Yeah.
Let's go.
And people have been pretty generous with the 5-star reviews, so let's keep those coming. Those are great. That really gets us up there in the search on iTunes. All right, thanks. Bye-bye.
Goodbye.